Thank you, Mrs. Cobb, for the special music. It's one of my, I love that piece, just beautiful words and a beautiful melody. And it fits well with what we're going to talk about today. We're going to get into, for those who didn't receive my pastor's update, we have a lot of guests. I sent out a pretty long post from John Cooper. So back in 2019, there was a small batch of well-known Christian leaders who decided that they no longer wanted to be Christians. They started to renounce their faith as Christians, and they kind of tagged the line or the term deconstruct. And they disagreed with either an element of Christianity, the entire concept of Christianity, or aspects of it. And so they started to shift away from it. These people who were pillars for the Christian community. And they kind of started rebuffing the cultural beliefs behind it, and they rejected those. It got a little bit of attention, but then after John Cooper, who is the lead singer for the Christian rock band Skillet, he made this post that I sent out last night. If you didn't have a chance to read the whole thing, and for those who didn't get it at all, I'm going to read a couple clips of what he posted, because he hits at the core of Christianity, of what we're supposed to be doing. And so this is what he wrote in a post that he made, and this is just a couple of the lines out of it. He says, "We are in a dangerous place when the church is looking to 20-year-old worship singers as our source of truth. We now have a church culture that learns who God is from singing modern praise songs rather than from the teachings of the word. So this is someone whose life is built around music, who presents to this genre. He's going, "You're looking at us." And then he continued later and he says, "It is time for the church to rediscover the preeminence of the word and to value the teaching of the word. We need to value truth over feelings, truth over emotion." And then at the very end, he ends with Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 8. It says, "The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever." There's not much more truth than that, is there? God's truth does stand forever. And Peter actually cites that verse right there later on when he's talking about the fleetingness of human life, of us being these physical beings that were never intended to last forever. So Peter quotes that and uses it, that we can't count on tomorrow. We look at today, we try to do the best that we can today to grow and build a relationship with God, to build a relationship with Christ, and develop at the core who they are, that their character becomes our character, and that His Word stands forever. God's plan stands forever. It doesn't end. I found this statement, the entire post. If you didn't read it, you may want to go back to and look at my email, because his entire post, the majority of it is pretty spot on when we look at just the emotional detachment that we have sometimes, or when we get rooted into the wrong focus of what our relationship is supposed to be and how that's supposed to work with God. We see these men and women out there who are striving to do right by God. And so we see these people out there who sometimes make these statements, and we know that they haven't had the full truth, but they're right at the cusp. They're right there just at the edge of figuring things out, and we know that they can't get it until God opens their eyes. But they sometimes make these profound statements that really help us to solidify what we're supposed to be doing, what our job is, what our goal is. And even though we're not supposed to have these highs, as physical human beings, we are physical, we're mental, we're emotional, we're chemically driven, and we're spiritually driven. We have all of this that makes us who we are, and especially for our youth. As you guys are growing and developing, all of these things are changing rapidly, and we have to try to sort through some of that and focus on what really matters, this relationship that we have with our Father and with Jesus Christ and with each other. And that's the core of what we're doing, and we have to be rooted in doctrine. It's not these emotional highs that make us feel good for a couple hours and then we go back home and the rest of our week is just normal like everything else. That's the core of who we are. What we feel today when we're around these people in God's Word, that should be our day-to-day life. That's our minute-to-minute reality of what we're trying to do when we're trying to please God and connect with Him and recognize that we want to take part in His plan, that we want to be part of that. We want to be there in the kingdom, serving, helping, guiding, so others can see this way of life. We want to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. That's what we do. That's our job right now. Now, discipleship, it's a unique word. When we think about discipling and discipleship, it's not like a teacher, it's not like a boss who we want to be like, who's trying to teach us things, right? When you have teachers, they're giving you knowledge, they're giving you information, they're feeding this to you, and you're supposed to regurgitate it in some form to pass a test or produce some type of proof that you understand what they're teaching you. For bosses, sometimes we try to glean as much information from our bosses so that we can do our job better, maybe ultimately trying to take over their job. If they move up in the company, we try to move up behind them so we can fulfill these different roles. That's not what a disciple is. A disciple is actually an imitator of the teacher. So if you showed up to class next time dressed like your teacher, in the same clothes, talking like your teacher, acting like your teacher, doing everything that they did, that would be a discipleship. You would be a disciple of them. And when you think about all the apostles and the disciples that were around Jesus Christ, that's why they tried to act like him. That's why we saw with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they'd always have all these men around them who were dressed like them, who walked like them, talked like them. They wanted to be their rabbi. As disciples of Jesus Christ, our job is to be like Christ. We want to mirror that. It's not just be a good student, but it is to mirror who he is, mirror what he is. That's what we're doing. That's our job. So today, the title for my sermon is Three Questions for You and Me. Three questions for you and me. What I want to go through, I want to look at three different questions that Jesus Christ asked the disciples at some point while he walked the earth. Each of you will have to answer these questions if you want to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, if you want to have a relationship with God. And this isn't just this surface level that you show up to service, Sabbath services, you keep the holy days, and the rest of the time you're acting like the rest of the world. That's not what we're doing. When we disciple, we have to be like Christ 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. This is our job, and this is what we're doing. And it can be exciting. It's exciting when we do that, but it's not these highs and lows. I want to begin by heading over to Matthew chapter 16. If you want to turn to Matthew chapter 16 and verse 13 with me. This is where we find the first question that you are each going to have to answer. This job that we have to make sure that we understand what we're doing here, understand the plan of God, who God is, and who Jesus Christ is. And that's what we get to right here. It's Matthew chapter 16. If you start in verse 13, it says, when Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And so they said, Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And then he gets real personal with them. So he asks them this generic question of, oh, who do other people think I am? And then in verse 15 he said to them, but who do you say I am? Who do you say I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. There's a lot of big opinions and big names about who Jesus Christ was at that time. He did a lot of miracles. He made a pretty big name for himself. And so there was a lot of ideas, John the Baptizer, Elijah, Jeremiah, or some other resurrected prophet. The people had different ideas of who he was. But none of those live up to who he really is. None of those fulfill what his actual goal was, what his job was to come here on earth and walk this earth. So question number one is, who do you say that I am? We have to answer who Christ is. We have to know who he is. We have to know his true identity. And it seems like Peter aced this one, right? Peter aced it. He goes, I know exactly who you are. He goes, you're the Christ. You are the Son of the living God. And Christ goes, yep, you're right. He goes, you're right. He goes, but you didn't get that information, you didn't get that knowledge, you didn't get that understanding because you just read. He goes, that came from God. And that's where we look at the rest of the world and go, they haven't had their chance yet. Some of them right there at the edge of it, but they just, God for some reason has withheld some information that they don't have the full understanding. He's opened it up to you and me that we can understand who He is and what He's doing. And if you drop down to verse 20, it says, then He commanded His disciples that they should tell no one that He was Jesus the Christ. So there's this plan that God has where He doesn't want everybody to know. At that point, everybody wasn't supposed to know who Christ was. Today, not everybody's supposed to know who Christ is. There's an order to what He's doing. There's a discipline to the plan of God that He's working through it to fulfill exactly what He wants done. We don't know all the answers to why some of this is, and it's difficult and frustrating at times, but He gives us the answers that not everyone's supposed to know. And that's some of the most confusing parts is when we go, well, why can't they figure this out? We can show them exactly where things are in the Bible, and they just can't quite figure it out. Now, thankfully, we have the Old Testament and the New Testament. We've got commentaries that help break down what was going on in society. We can understand on a different level exactly who Jesus Christ is, what His job was, what He fulfilled, who He is now. We know who God the Father is now. We can go through all of this because we have the knowledge here, but also because God has opened something up for you. God has done something in your life. Jesus Christ wasn't a created being. He wasn't just a human being from two human parents. He's the Son of God who came with a specific mission of saving humanity. Saving humanity. Well, today we don't have all the time in the world to analyze every single one of these aspects of those roles of who He was. You know, everything from being a descendant of Judah to His divine origin, right? He was not born or created. He's always existed. But we know that He was the sacrifice for us. He was the mediator of the new covenant. It's because of His sacrifice that we can go before God, that we can have a relationship with our Father. And that's what's important. Because that's how we become a son or daughter of God, is to have that relationship with Him. Turn over to Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15 with me. This is Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15. And as you head over there, I want to remind you of a couple of things that were said. You know, in John and his gospel recorded Christ being accused of blasphemy because he didn't find it an error to be equal with God, to have God as his Father, to be on the same plane as that. And we find in Philippians, it's written that Christ didn't consider it robbery to be equal with God. We see this relationship that he had, this plane that the God family is on, that they are working together, working in unison for the greater good, a greater goal. This is what we find in Colossians 1. If you pick it up in verse 15, we'll read it down through verse 18. It says, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by Him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or principalities, dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and in all things in Him all things consist. And He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn of the dead, that in all things He may have the preeminence. This is a pretty lengthy list and points out some of the major characteristics of who He is. And we ask that question of who am I? When we look at Him and we say, we know who you are. He points out that He's like God. He's a first fruit. He's from the beginning. He created. He's the creator. He's the head of the church. These are all significant portions of who He is right now that we have to recognize and understand and have the humility to accept that. That's where we start to get away from the, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to make the choices that I want to make. I'm going to live the life that I want to have. And we get down and say, okay, what is it that you want me to do? How do I live like you? And I know that that means I may have to give some of these things up. That's the difficult reality that we are in, that there are a lot of choices out there that we have to make, and sometimes it's difficult to make the good ones. It's difficult to give up the things that look fun and exciting, that'll give us that either emotional high or physical high at that time, and go, no, there's a greater point of what I'm doing now. There's a greater job that you have for me, and if I just hold out a little bit longer and I stay on the course, then I'll make it there. Head over to John chapter 21 and verse 15. So we have to know who he is. We find the second question over here in John chapter 21 and verse 15 that we have to answer. So this was after Jesus Christ was resurrected. Some of the disciples went fishing. They didn't catch anything again. We find a lot of the times they go fishing, they don't catch things. So I don't know if they weren't good fishermen or if God just made things hard for them at times to make a big point. But here in chapter 21, verse 15, they see somebody standing on the shore. They don't recognize at first that it's Christ. And as soon as they recognize who it is, Peter throws on his cloak and he jumps in the water and swims to him. He doesn't even wait to paddle in. He just beelines it straight to the shore. And they eat breakfast together. This is what it says in John chapter 21. If you look at verses 19 all the way down through 20, I'm sorry, we're going to start in verse 15 and then we'll go down through 19. He says, "So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?' He said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said to him, 'Feed my lambs.'" He reiterates this question three times to him. So pay close attention to how he frames this. We're going to break this down. So he says, "Feed my lambs." He said to him again, a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know I love you. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me. Follow me." Question number two, do you love me? So the first one is, do you know who I am? And then number two is, do you love me? This may seem like a silly question, especially when he's asking it to Peter. Peter was the brash and bold one at times who claimed that Christ shouldn't wash his feet and that he would never deny him and do all of these things. And so when Christ asked him that, he was expressing this depth of love that he says, "Do you love me?" Now for us, oftentimes we throw around the word pretty easily. I love the Bengals. I love ice cream. I'm working on everybody else here to love the Bengals. It's taking a little bit more time. I've got big feet ahead of me. But I love things, right? We all love things. There's things that we love, and even in relationships, sometimes we throw it around pretty easily if I love you. But there's a depth here that Christ uses that's a lot bigger magnitude than these things that we like, these things that we enjoy. Because there's an interesting wordplay here in the Greek text when he goes through these three questions. And when Jesus asks that, the word that Christ used there in the first two times, it's apagao. It comes from the word agape. It comes from that word agape, the highest love there is. The love of God. This implies this total commitment, turning over our lives to Him. And Peter was painfully aware of that. He stands there because he's remembering his disobediences. He's remembering his failings, his shortcomings. He'd felt the guilt that he wasn't to live up to some of the standards that he said he would do. And Christ asked him here. And remember, not too long ago, he denied Christ 3 times. When Christ was taken, he denied him 3 times. And I'm sure this is fresh on his mind when Christ is standing there going, "Do you love me? Do you have this highest love and respect for me?" That had to have been painfully weighing down on him, knowing that he didn't live up to that. So that old Peter, the brash pronouncements of what he was going to do in the past, now we see this broken and humbled spirit. He was fully aware of his shortcomings, fully aware that he couldn't live up to that highest love. He couldn't live up to that expectation that he was just asked. And Peter uses a different word when he says, "You know I love you." He uses the word phileo. It still means love, but it's a less lofty term that signifies affection. He goes, "You know I love you. You know I love you." He was acknowledging that he did love him, but he made that differentiation saying, "I can't love you the way that you're asking me to. I don't measure up to that." He was acknowledging his shortcomings. He knew what Christ deserved. He knew who he was and what he did. And so he kind of plays with that word there. But Christ here still commissioned him, right? He says, "Feed my lambs. Feed my lambs." The word here for feed is the verb bosco. It means, this was a term that herdsmen used when they were taking their sheep out to pasture and feeding their livestock. So it was to feed them, to give them the nourishment that they needed. And so this is that word. And he also denotes, we see this translation of believers are referred to as these lambs, right? Young sheep. Somebody who's still slightly immature. Immature, vulnerable. They need, sometimes their needs to be fulfilled by others. So that's that first initial wordplay that we see there. And so in order to reinforce this point, Christ asks him again, agapao. He says, "Do you love me?" He uses the same term that second time. He knew he couldn't live up to it. He goes, "You know I love you. You know I love you." He was recognizing his omniscience. He goes, "You know everything. You know that I love you." But he still used the phileo. He goes, "I can't measure up to what you're asking me right now." He goes, "I do love you. I've shown you that." And Christ charges him here with, "Tend my sheep." So he changes his words a little bit. Christ uses a synonym instead of bosco. That word for tend there, it's a synonym. It's a synonym. It's the word poimaino. There's a little more depth here. It does mean to feed and tend, to nourish, but it also means to cherish one's body, to serve the body. He says, "Serve my body, tend to them. These sheep." He goes, "You have a job that I have for you." And so he's expressing this duty that he wants him to obtain. And so we see this wordplay, and Christ isn't done with him yet. He doesn't stop at that second time. He asks him one more time, "Do you love me?" And it said that Peter was grieved. Well, why would he be grieved at this point? And Christ is standing there with him, back with him. He's grieved because of that word choice. Because this time, Christ uses phileo. He says, "Do you love me?" He dropped it down and said, "Do you love me like this now?" He goes, "I know you can't hit agape." He goes, "Do you love me, phileo?" It was that less than total devotion. Kind of settling, saying, "Okay, I know you can't measure up." But he says, "It's safe for you to claim this one. You can love me like this, right?" It's implying that his total life, his total dependency of love, this broke Peter's heart. Because could you imagine standing there with Christ, the Savior, our mediator? He goes, "Do you love me?" And we can't say it back to the same degree. We can't tell him, I love you the way you need to be loved. And Peter had that recognition. He was grieved. It hurt. It hurt to know that he couldn't fulfill that. It kind of, when we disappoint our parents, we've done something dumb, we have to go and either we get caught or we admit it. There's that embarrassment, that shame that we have because we didn't fulfill those expectations. It's kind of what Peter was going through. But he leans more heavily on the omniscience again. He looks at Christ and he goes, you know all things. He didn't just say, you know I love you. He goes, you know all things. You know I love you. This is a big lesson for us. When we recognize our failures, we recognize our imperfections. And for Peter, even with his shortcomings, Christ still commissioned him with a job. Still had a role for him to play. He says, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. He's giving him a job. Even though we can't always measure up to God's perfect character, he wants us to try. That's why he continued to use Peter and give Peter these jobs. He goes, I know you can do better. I know that you're the one that can fill a lot of these roles. Every single one of us in this room have roles to fill. We have ways of serving. But just as Peter recognized here, we each have to realize we can't rely on our own strength. We can't rely on our own power, our own successes. Our success only comes through a reliance on God's power. When we talk about eternity and being part of God's kingdom and the success of all of that, we have to have a humble awareness of our shortcomings, our limitations. The true love edifies, it improves, it increases, it makes things better, it brings out joy. That's what true love is. We should treasure the counsel, the wonderful counsel that we have from God. The words in this book, the friends that we have, those who have come before us that have experience that we can sit down with and talk with. We have to cherish that. We have to grow because there will be times that we slip. There will be times that we stumble. And when we have to get up and we learn from our lessons, hopefully there's a hand there to help us up and dust us off. As we continue to build our relationship with God, as we continue to build our relationship with Christ, understanding the value of what true love is, that forgiving love, that grace that we have, that's been extended to us. We have to love Him. We have to answer that question, do you love me? Head over to Matthew chapter 24 now. This is where we find the third question. Matthew chapter 24, if you look at verse 45. This falls within the Olivet Prophecy. And if you remember, the Olivet Prophecy focuses heavily on a prophecy about the church. It has a bigger impact on us as far as recognizing what's going on, what's going to be happening, how things are going to play out. The disciples were constantly wanting to know when the end was, when Christ was going to return. They sometimes fought about what positions they would have in these disputes. But I want to pick this up here in Matthew chapter 24. If you look at verse 45 down through 52, we'll read that to the end. So here it says, who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find doing so. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants, to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on the day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So question number three, we have to ask ourselves, am I a servant of the king? Am I a servant of the king? That's one of those positions. If we recognize who Christ is, right? Who am I? The first question, who am I? We have to know who He is. He is the King. He's the one that's going to bring the kingdom of God to establish it on earth. If we are more concerned about what positions we hold, what knowledge we have, how much authority we'll have, we are missing the point. We have to look at how can I serve? How can I be a servant? If we're not, we have a real big problem. Because Christ advises us to be busy. We just read through those three questions where Peter was told, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. He was given these jobs. We are given the same jobs at times. Slight variations, different gifts that we have to help. We're not only supposed to be growing in truth and knowledge. Now, that's a big part of it, but that doesn't mean anything if we don't apply it to our lives. If we don't apply it to those around us, we can have all the knowledge in the world. Our example is going to speak a whole lot louder than any words that we can tell people. We have to be doing. That leads us to love humanity on a whole new level. Right? Not only do you love me, because that's where it starts. When we recognize who Christ is, we recognize the love that we have for Him, the love we have for God, the love for each other, that extends to everybody. All of humanity. It creates something different in us. And this section of Scripture has a scary warning, because it not only talks about a good servant, but then He calls a servant evil. He says there's an evil servant in this. He says there's a potential for you to fall off the wagon, for you to slip up. He says, and you can become an evil servant. Not just put truth on the back burner. Not just put understanding or our Bible study or prayer life on the back burner. He says this is an evil servant. All of those things lead us into being an evil servant. That's when we start to break away from the truth. And we head down this dark path and we find ourselves struggling. Struggling to find which way is up. Struggling to find a reality of what matters, what doesn't matter. And it says, when we find ourselves here, you will beat His fellow servants. It says He beat His fellow servants. Didn't just not care for them or tend for them. It says He beat them. There's a lack of love for them. He didn't just not take care of them. There was backbiting. There was gossiping. Maybe there was physical harm. All of these things is a warning for us to say, how do we care for one another? How do we honor and respect each other? What are we doing for each other? It's not just words, but it's a combination of words and actions of what we're supposed to be doing. And He says, when this happens, if this is the path you're sliding down, then the world's enjoyable things are going to become your priority. That's going to be your focus. So much to the point that you may even lose control of yourself because you're overindulging and eating and drinking and whatever the world has. He goes, you become part of that. It controls your mind. It becomes your focus. He says you start to act like Satan's world because you become part of Satan's world. Christ said, I'll come when you're not prepared. And you won't see me coming. You won't hear me coming. And that's why we constantly have to be working to improve. We constantly work to grow, to get rid and shed the old man. As we're approaching Passover in just a couple of weeks, we're refocusing our lives and thinking even more heavily on that recommitment that we make for those who are baptized. That commitment that we've made with God of saying, I'm going to do my best to live like you, to be like Christ. And we sometimes see those shortcomings and we go, how did I end up here? And we have to revamp and reprocess, and it takes time and it takes effort. But we have to become a servant. Flip over to James chapter 1 and verse 27. I want to look at a couple places. Sometimes we forget about these people, but it specifically addresses a way that we're to be serving. It's James chapter 1 and verse 27. The section here starts with being a doer of the work, not just a hearer, right? Applying it, doing the things that we're supposed to after hearing it, being engaged, actively engaged, practicing living like Christ, being that role model, being a disciple, mirroring what Christ would have done. And it says none of this matters if you don't actually apply it. This is what it says in James 1, verse 27. It says, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So these people who may live in the most difficult situations, physical situations, right? Widows and orphans. And he says, and then don't just throw away everything else to be part of this world. Not only that, take care of them, but he says, don't let the world corrupt you. Don't let the influences sink in and attach themselves to you and draw you away. He says, you have to be careful. You know, we have shut-ins here in the Indianapolis area, Muncie, Fort Wayne. We have a pretty big area where we do have shut-ins. Men and women who haven't been able to be here with us. For me, when I miss one Sabbath, it hurts. Like, one Sabbath is all it takes for me going, man, feels like it's been forever since I've been to church. We feed off of each other. That's that spiritual side of us, the physical combining with the spiritual, that we lift each other up, that we edify one another. We make each other feel good, knowing that there's others who are striving to do things right. Get over some of these hurdles. We have some who haven't been able to be here for months, years. Just think about how that feels. Not to have this, I'll call it an emotional high. We get an emotional high when we come here to the Sabbath, right? Now it doesn't end there. That's not the extent of just the emotional high. We're supposed to apply that. We're supposed to let that sink in. But they don't ever have that. They miss being here. Now the phone calls and texts, visits, even people showing up to drop off groceries or a meal or to take out their trash. All of these things have a big, big impact on their life. There's people that have situations where they just can't be here. And we're told that not to forget them. Don't forget about these people. And then flip over to 1 Timothy 5 and verse 3. This section starts out by addressing how to treat other church members. And it quickly shifts to the widows. But it makes a distinction. It does something we sometimes find odd here, because it classifies, it makes a delineation between just widows and what it calls true widows. This is 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 3. It's making a distinction between those who are actually just alone, who have nobody else, versus those who have family to rely on. If you look at verse 3, it says, honor widows who are really widows, but if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is a good and acceptable before God. You know, it's our responsibility to care for each other. We have a responsibility to care for the family. Spiritual family, physical family. We are to care for those that we have this bond with, this relationship with. Piety is not a common word that we use anymore, but it is the quality of being religious or reverent. Now, we know none of us are reverent. We don't use the term for pastors of reverent, because we know nobody's reverent but God. But we're trying to attain that. Right? We're trying to measure up to that. We're trying to put the character of God on. We're trying to mirror Christ's image. And if we do that, we're living up to those expectations. We never succeed fully, but that's where we're heading. That's where we're going. And he says, for those who took care of you, who have done things for you, who have your blood, maybe you don't even have blood, but it was who was in your family, right? Families consist of a lot of different things. He goes, you're to care for them. They're your responsibility. He says, care for your own. And if you drop down a couple to verse 8, Verse 8 says, but if anyone does not provide for his own and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Again, we have this harsh warning that he goes, you're just like the rest of the world. You're just like everybody else. He goes, if you don't measure up to this, if you don't actually do your responsibility, you're worse than an unbeliever. These are scary for us to look at times because these are dangers that we can fall into. These are warnings for us. These are warnings of how we're to live our life and what we're supposed to actually do. And then it moves down through and actually it talks about some of the younger widows because it says there's a warning saying, hey, you guys can get yourselves in trouble, you younger widows, if you're not really careful. You can deviate very quickly. So he actually encourages them to remarry at some point, to not fall into the traps of the world. And then if you drop down, it finishes here in verse 16. It's not the very end of it, but this section here in verse 16. He says, if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them. Do not let the church be burdened that it may relieve those who are really widows. So again, it's saying we take care of our responsibilities. We care for those so there's not this greater burden. Ultimately, we are a family. We are the body of Christ. That's part of the acknowledgement of who am I? Who do people say that I am? When we look at Christ as the head of the body and we recognize what he does for us, leading this example, we are family. We are tied together, we are bonded together, and we can't let any of us slip through the cracks. We don't want anybody to struggle. We have this job. We have these jobs that have been laid out for us. And it's that servant attitude that we read in Matthew. Are you a good servant or are you an evil servant? There's lots of levels of that. He breaks it down on several different levels. Not just being a servant, not just caring for one another, but really digging in deep. And we can think about those different words, agape versus phileo. Not just this low level of I love you that we throw around, but this godly love that he looks at us and he treats us like children. He wants us as part of his family. That's how we have to extend to each other. And he calls that true religion. Right? That's what we read just a minute ago. It says pure and undefiled religion. It's caring for each other. Having these relationships. It's not just emotional highs and lows that come and go. But it's actually at our core. It's being called a disciple. It's completing the task that we have. Living our life completely in service to God. In service to each other. And so as you work through those, think about the answers that you would have to those questions. Think about if Christ was there and asked you those three questions. Because we have to know who Christ is. We have to know his role as not only the Savior, but as the mediator. That gateway to the Father. Having a relationship with him. We have to embody love. The highest level of love and respect for each other. And it takes a lot of humility. That can be really hard at times. Not everybody's easily loved. I know I can be pretty stinking hard to love at times. My wife would rather take a baseball bat to me than love me. And most time it's deserved. Not all the time. Sometimes it's hard. But he says we work at it. He goes, we work at it. These are the things that God is working us through. These three questions, we have to understand who he is. We have to understand the love that he expects because he extends it to everybody else. And am I a servant? Are we doing that? If we can do those, if we can answer those, that's putting on God's character. That's living like Jesus Christ. All those things kind of flow together. Right? Knowing who God is, that makes us excited to love others. Knowing the love that he extended us makes it easier to love everyone else. And when we have that love, it's easier to serve. It's easier to make those commitments. It spurs us on because you're not just called for salvation. That's part of the plan, but you're called to fulfill a job. You're called to work hard. And so as disciples, be firm in your faith, let love flow from you, and serve diligently.